From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The title of Andrew Solomon's book is the first clue. It comes from the maxim that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But what if it does? What if you're a parent and your child isn't really like you? What if she's gay? What if he's a genius? What if she's severely disabled or has Down syndrome or is a dwarf? What if he has schizophrenia or was conceived in a rape? Then what? Solomon began thinking about this more than 10 years ago. At first, he was exploring identity, but he kept meeting exceptional children and their exceptional parents, and the project expanded and became deeply personal. Today in the program, Solomon is joining us to talk about the book, what he's learned from families who aren't just coping with their exceptional children, they're finding purpose and profound meaning in the experience. Far from the tree, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Andrew Solomon is our guest, here to talk about his acclaimed book, Far From the Tree. It's the result of some 10 years of research on families coping with children who are different from their parents, kids who are born autistic or deaf or who are prodigies, children who are dwarfs or transgender or conceived in rape. The book is a study of families who accept their children and how that relates, as he puts it in the book, to those children's self-acceptance. He says it's a universal struggle we negotiate partly through the minds of others. It's an epic and personal book that explores not just what it takes to live with exceptional children, but how you find meaning in that experience. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon is a lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts. His book about depression, The Noonday Demon, won the National Book Award back in 2001. And he's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Andrew Solomon, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
What a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start. In the book, you say you began your research aggrieved. And I wanted to start there. Because I guess in some ways what got you thinking about this, or part of it anyway, was trying to understand what you saw as, I guess, the failings of the way your parents had raised you as an exceptional child, as a gay child.
Right. So the point that I think I've made starting at the beginning of the book is that my parents really had a struggle to accept me for who I am, and I had a struggle to accept myself for who I am, and my struggle was considerably complicated by the fact that they were struggling. So there was a lot of tension one way and another around this subject and a lot of pain around it. And I really became interested in the idea as I worked on this book that people have all kinds of children who are different from them in some radical way. And that it's almost always difficult for them. But I definitely felt that my parents – I felt that they didn't love me, which I ultimately decided wasn't true. What they didn't do for a while was accept me. Yeah. I think they loved me all the way through.
I guess for a while you figured you were – I think this is how you put it in the book – part of the slim minority. I wonder if you were surprised at how many kindred communities you had out there.
Oh, it was a real revelation. I mean, the point at which the – book began first to sparkle on the horizon was when I was doing research in the deaf community and discovered that deafness, which I had always thought of as nothing but a miserable disability and a sort of terribly sad business for people not able to hear, actually existed as a linguistic subculture and that there was a lot of vitality in the world of the deaf. And then a friend of mine had a child who was a dwarf and was trying to figure out how to bring that child up with self-esteem, good self-esteem. And I suddenly thought, oh, this experience of parents who have a child who's different, most deaf children are born to hearing parents, most dwarfs are born to parents of average height, most gay kids are born to straight parents. All the time you have these parents who are essentially see themselves as being in some way normal and who have children whom they see as being in some way different and frequently as being somehow deficient. And how do these things relate to each other? How do the parents experience the children? How do the children experience themselves? And how does the experience of the children and the parents change or affect the larger social acceptance of the conditions in question?
This assignment that you had writing about deaf culture, I mean, this was years ago, 1993, I think it was. So how is it that that became this project? And I guess the question is, did you think it would be a 10-year project? And which, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but did you think it would become so personal?
I certainly didn't think it would be a 10-year project. I don't think I had any understanding when I started of how ambitious the idea was and of how much research it would take. But having found that I had this unlikely common cause with the deaf, and I wrote about that in the original Times piece in the early 90s, I then found that I also had, in some way that I hadn't understood was likely or possible, common cause with people who are dwarfs. And I thought, well, who else then? Yeah. Who else is dealing with this situation? And investigating these different kinds of conditions, situations, illnesses, identities, whichever word one wants to use as one looks across them, I began to – it just kept broadening and broadening and broadening until I finally thought, actually, to have parents who perceive themselves as being completely normal, who have children, all of whom they perceive to be completely normal, that's the rare and unusual thing.
Yeah.
And families dealing with children who are in some measure or in some degree, not always as extreme as what I've written in the book, but frequently so, to have parents who in some measure or some degree are dealing with difference and are dealing with a child who presents unexpected challenges, that's actually the more normal experience.
Mm. I want to talk about those that you chose to write about, and we'll break some of this down as we go along. But those who are deaf, dwarfs, as you mentioned, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, prodigies, people conceived in rape, transgender was one. And as I said, we'll get to that. But I'm also interested in the ones you decided not to write about, ones that you would – in the book anyway, you talk about at least thinking about it. At least I get a sense of that. Irreligious parents, for example, of fundamentalist children. There's a difference. Parents of children with dyslexia or other disabilities. Parents of obese children. I mean, what did you decide to leave out, and what did you decide to put in? Was some of this just a practical matter?
Well, those are all categories, the ones you listed, that I did contemplate including.
Yeah.
And yes, at some level it was a practical matter. It's ended up being a fairly bulky book as it is. And I just didn't think I could write about 20 topics. I had to narrow it. There are some I really regret losing. I regret losing the chapter I was going to do on families of children with terminal illnesses.
Yeah.
I regret losing the chapter I was going to do on people who set out to adopt disabled children, trying to understand what the motives are and what the dynamics are. I thought about doing a chapter on families of people who've committed suicide, but I also felt like I wanted to do possibly some more of the sort of more upbeat chapter. So I was interested in the dynamics around religiosity that you mentioned, when either the parent or the child has a very different set of religious beliefs. I was interested in immigration and the way in which parents whose children have come to another country end up really sometimes identifying with different cultures and with different backgrounds.
Mm.
I thought about doing supermodels and their not very unusual looking families.
Wow. Is that right?
So, it was all out there. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And but the
I finally, when I chose – sorry.
No, go,
I was
no,
just
going
to say, when I finally chose the topics, the other thing was that I tried not to do things that overlap too much. So if I was writing about dwarfism, I didn't need to write about gigantism because even though there are similarities and differences, the similarities are sufficient so that I thought it could become somewhat repetitive.
The question comes up in these issues of identity. What's an identity and what's an illness? You know, what do you leave alone and what do you correct? It's a major theme in the book, it seems, the difference between those. And you write this, you write that many conditions are both illness and identity, but we can see only one when we obscure the other. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. I really started off from the position that when I was a child, being gay was seen as an illness, a sin, and a crime, and that now we have a president who has come out in favor of gay marriage. And I said, okay, if this has gone from being an illness, which is certainly how I experienced it when I was a child, to being an identity, which is certainly the way that I live it now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I then saw a parallel process that had taken place for many people within the deaf community in which even though the larger world still sees them primarily as disabled, they themselves have a strong sense of identity, I thought, where else is that shift taking place?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the tension between the medical progress that is allowing us to control or even eliminate some of these conditions and the social progress that is allowing us to accept or even celebrate the same conditions. And I really ended up thinking that you could experience anything as an illness, i.e. as something that prevented you from doing things that you might possibly want to do. Mm. And you could experience almost anything as an identity, i.e. as something that is central to the way you define yourself. So I finally felt that I could define being American, being Caucasian, being any of those things could be experienced in illness terms because they do all prevent me from doing certain things. I don't want to change them, but yeah, they do prevent me from doing certain things. And then equally, I felt that, as I wrote in the book, things like being a criminal, which seems like only a dark thing, becomes in many ways an identity for many people. So I wanted to break down the divide we have in which we say very clearly, well, this is a disability and this is actually just an eccentricity, or this is really something that needs to be cured and this is something that needs to be celebrated. And mm-hmm. Then you have to look at everything in both ways if you want to see it clearly.
It's interesting. I wanted you to talk about Deborah Kent. Because her story is interesting in terms of, I have to say, it was kind of surprising in the way she looked at her condition, or the condition of being blind anyway, as identity. That was a surprising, I think, revelation. Talk about Deborah Kent, if you would.
So Deborah Kent wrote an essay, which I've talked about at some length in the opening chapter of the book, in which she really was discussing the fact that she was blind, that she had what she thought of as a very good and happy marriage,
yeah,
that she became pregnant and then had a child, and that her husband was very focused on whether the child would be blind or not, mm-hmm, and was very full of celebration and delight when the child turned out to be seeing. And she found his response made her feel, I think she said, very much alone, and it makes her feel very much alone when she thinks back on it, because she said she felt that her blindness was a quality about her but not something that she particularly regretted, that she didn't see how she could have had a better life under any other circumstances. And she didn't know why her husband would be so concerned about the idea of having a deaf child, given that he'd spent time with her and seen how fulfilling her life was. And I thought it was a very complicated set of questions that she brought up, because on the one hand, it seems as though her life has been a good and positive and vital one. And on the other hand, I don't think it's possible to deny that it's easier in the world if you can see. And so the neutrality that she argued for about blindness struck me as it was striking, it was moving, it was also problematical.
The problematical part, I mean, how far can you stretch this idea of identity? I mean, you mentioned in the book, for example, coming up against the pro-Anna and pro-Mia movements.
Right.
Which is another extreme.
Yeah. Those are the movements that say that bulimia and anorexia are just a lifestyle and that they should be supported. And I said they're not just a lifestyle. They actually have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. And websites that are pro-Anna or pro-Mia are causing the unnecessary deaths of hundreds of young people. And we can't just say, well, it's an identity and they should explore their identity. It can get dark, this whole process.
You say in the book that at first, often I guess it works this way, parents see this as an illness. But then it seems like something happens. There's this transformation that seems to come from experience and from love, really. And they come up with what you call a new language of identity. What did you learn about this new language? Because you also write about this vocabulary that we have to come up with. It's to think about it, to explain it, I guess.
So I think that a lot of the families that I was writing about responded initially to the news of whatever way their child was different with horror. That's the way that people mostly respond to that kind of news, with alarm at the very least. And some of them really stayed in that place for a long time, and some of them managed to move past it. But I found over and over again that people were capable to a surprising degree of ultimately learning to see their child's experience as an identity, and that frequently happened as the child, him or herself, got to be old enough to be mixing in a peer group of people who shared their condition. And suddenly the parents saw the whole world and life of people with dwarfism, or suddenly the parents understood what the intimacies were that were connected to various physical disabilities, or parents who had a child who was a prodigy and a genius and whom they didn't know what to do with finds his own social context. And at that point, the parents are frequently able to be much more accepting than they were in the initial stretch of panic. And I was very interested in examining with each of these families, how did they make this progress? How did they get from that place of being distraught about what their child had to actually being deeply connected and saying, I would never give this child up for any other child in the world?
Do you think, after all of these years and all of these interviews, do you think you figured that out?
Well, I don't think it's something that can be fully figured out, but I think I figured out a lot of the dynamics of it. I mean, I for a while kept meeting people and thinking, oh, come on, you say you would never want any other child than the one you have, but look how much difficulty and trouble this child has brought into your life.
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, all of our children bring difficulty into our lives, and it's the very essence of parental attachment that we love them anyway. So if some glorious angel came through my living room ceiling and offered to take away my children and give me other, better, cleaner, funnier, better behaved children, I would be horrified and I would hold on to the children I have because I love them. And I thought that progress that is made in the context of children without problems or disabilities is kind of related to a progress that's made in children who do have problems and disabilities. Mm-hmm. It's not so different.
I was interesting how you wrote about the relationship between suffering and love, because you write that suffering does not necessarily imply love, but love implies suffering.
Right. So I think that the lives that I wrote about are hard lives. I don't want to deny that having a child with autism presents a lot of challenges, and I don't want to make some sort of sentimental argument that actually it's just as easy as anything else. It's not as easy as anything else. It's a struggle. Some people are able to rise to the occasion better than others, but it's a struggle nonetheless. But I did think that anyone loving anyone else, I mean, it's the essence of love. If in love you didn't try to protect the person you loved and fear the death of the person you love, and if you didn't have all of those anxieties that exist around the context of love, it wouldn't be love as we know it. You know, if you sort of thought, well, I have a terrific wife, but if she dies Tuesday, I'll meet someone else. It's not a problem. That's not love. And so I think love always involves some amount of suffering and difficulty, and that these people I was writing about represented only a more extreme version of that. Having said that, I thought there are also people who have children who have got special needs and challenges who don't find it incredibly meaningful and who right. don't figure out how to construct a more positive view of the world through their experience of their own children. And those people are the ones who are having suffering, sometimes without any real reward attached to it.
Mm. What happens when a parent – because you write a bit about this a chapter on severe disability, for example. You write about Julia. And there are those parents who I don't even know how to put it, don't or aren't willing to or don't want to go through that kind of experience.
There certainly are. And Julia, who I wrote about, had a child who she gave up for care and who was adopted by – not legally adopted, but was taken in by someone else as a foster child.
Yeah.
Child with very, very severe disabilities. You know, some people aren't cut out for this.
Yeah.
Some people aren't really cut out to be parents at all, and it's often hard to know whether you're cut out to be a parent until you are one, at which point it's too late to discover that it wasn't your strong suit. But people kept saying, oh, you're writing this huge book about all these depressing conditions. And I kept saying, it's actually not about these depressing conditions. It's about the resilience and strength of love even in the face of these conditions. It's about how people manage to have an adoring relationship with their own children even when confronted with these qualities which, if they had been described ahead of time, they would have thought would make it impossible for them to love those children. But in writing about people like that, I didn't mean or want in any way to invalidate the experience that many people have, which is that they have these children with challenging identities and it's more than they can deal with and they don't deal with it well. And it was important to include Julia's story, it was important to include the story of the woman in the autism chapter who said, I love my kids, I do everything for them, and if I'd known what they were going to be like, I wouldn't have had them, and I wish I hadn't, she said. And that's the truth, and anyone who tells you otherwise is lying. And I thought, well, it's not the whole truth, it's a piece of the truth. And some people who tell me otherwise genuinely feel otherwise. But, you know, I didn't want to whitewash the difficulty, but I did want to look at what the paths are through it.
Andrew Solomon is with us. His book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Andrew Solomon. We're talking about his acclaimed book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Andrew Solomon, your experience with your mother is interesting and kind of ironic in some way. I mean, you had dyslexia as a child, still have it. But your mother identified this, and she became, in this case anyway, I guess it's fair to say, one of those exceptional parents.
Yes, she did. She saw that I had dyslexia. She had been a teacher herself. She started working with me on reading when I was just 2 years old. I don't think at that point she realized it was dyslexia, but she realized that I was having some perceptual issues. And she worked with me constantly and steadily. And as I've said in the book, if I hadn't overcome the dyslexia or at least reached the point at which I could function very well despite having it, it might be central to my identity because I did, you know, almost no one who knows me knew I had dyslexia until I wrote about it in the book. But when I was a kid and applying to elementary schools in New York, they all said I would never learn to read or write, which I've had a lot of problems in life, but that isn't one of them.
Right. But how did that play against the other part of your identity, of course, which was different from your parents, which is the fact that you were gay? I mean, because this is something they had a hard time with, that there were limits, as you put it. I mean, they could cope with the dyslexia, I suppose, but when you asked for a pink balloon at a party, there's the boundary, I guess.
Right. So I think the fact that my mother had achieved so much success in trouncing the neurological abnormality of my dyslexia made her feel as though it was possible to fix or change everything. And one of the central arguments of the book is that you need to understand what can be fixed and changed and what cannot be fixed and changed. It's a version of that old serenity prayer, and you have to then decide which things you're going to fix and change and which things you aren't. So I feel my mother's attempts to resolve my dyslexia were a huge success, and I'm incredibly grateful to her. I'm a writer. If I had not had that attention, I probably wouldn't be, and I would regret it deeply. But her attempts somehow to resolve my gayness and to fix that problem were traumatic for her, traumatic for me, and highly unproductive.
And one of the – I guess the principal insight about your parents that you came to was that it wasn't that they didn't love you. It's that they didn't understand how to deal with this thing that was different from them.
Exactly. I mean, I felt it was a little bit as though I had woken up one day and said that all of our future communication would have to be in Arabic. They didn't know it. They didn't understand it. They didn't understand where it had suddenly come from. It was all more than they were up for initially. And then over time, they actually got used to it and came around to it and were very much part of the life that I've made for myself. And my father in particular has been – my mother died 22 years ago. My father has been incredibly supportive and incredibly engaged with the life I've made and the family I've made. So – but it was a process. And what I discovered in looking at all of these other families is it's always a process and it always takes time. Sometimes it takes more time. Sometimes it takes less time. There's always a process involved. And the parents often have to find meaning not only in what their child is going through but also in what they're going through, because if you have a child who's gay, that's a change not only in your child's identity but also in your identity as the parent of a gay child, and you have to figure out how to come to terms with that and how to make sense of it. You know, I think a lot about one of the families I wrote about, Tom and Karen Robards and their son David. And David has Down syndrome, and his parents got very involved in changing the way that educational services are delivered to people with Down syndrome and did really a remarkable job and are in part responsible for the much better education that people with DS now get. And I said, this has been such a huge part of your life. I said, do you wish it hadn't been? Do you wish that David didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you'd never heard of it? And his father said, well, I wish that for David, he said, but I'm not sure I wish it for myself. Mm-hmm. And his mother said, I really feel, she said, for David, I would cure it in an instant because it's a difficult way to be in the world and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for myself, though I would never have believed 26 years ago when he was born that I could get to such a point, speaking for myself, it's made me a better, kinder person and given me a more interesting and useful life than I would otherwise have had. Mm. And speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
Yeah. I want to there's a in this chapter on disability, you introduce us to Ruth Schechter and Bill Zirinsky. And one of the really interesting features about your book is it's taken on another life online where you have these interviews that people can go online, and we'll give people a link to this website, but where you can actually hear some of the people that you've talked to, see them, talking about reflecting back on the experiences. And you were mentioning how it deepens their lives, and Bill talks about this. You want to say something about Ruth Schechter and Bill Zirinsky? Because I want to play something that Bill says about Juliana.
Well, they're remarkable people. They had two children. They had a child who was born with very severe disabilities. No one could understand where they came from, but they were told that it was most likely a random occurrence. And then they had a second child who had the same very severe difficulties. One of their children was never able to walk or talk. The younger one was able to walk a very little bit, but never developed language. Neither of them developed the ability to feed himself or herself, so they had to be fed through various technical means and so on. So there were parents who had these terrible problems, and yet they absolutely loved and adored these children, and they were incredibly dedicated to and devoted to them and experienced in them a kind of shimmering humanity. And they talked about how frustrating it was when other people thought they were just putting on a good face, or that they, you know, really it was miserable and awful, but poor Ruth and Bill. And they found a lot of meaning in it. And the thing that was most striking to me was when I was talking to Ruth and she said, I feel like it isn't that the meaning is there. She said, it's that the meaning can be found. Yeah. And we have had an experience of our children, which is an experience of intimacy and love and joy and meaning, because we sought that out and because we decided that was how we were going to respond to it. It's always a choice. It's always a decision.
Here's a Bill talking about, he'll refer to Sam, who died when he was 9 years old. I think that's right. Is that right, Andrew Solomon?
Yes, that's right.
And he talks about how losing him wasn't, in fact, a relief, which is what you would think in some ways, although that sounds crass. But here's Bill Zirinsky from Far From the Tree.
Finding spiritual meaning in Sam's life and in his in him being part of our family, and Juliana too, has informed, has really been an important reason why we've had a really good attitude, about being the parents of Sam and Juliana. You know, I do believe that Sam and Juliana are gifts in our lives. I feel fortunate that I'm the parent of Juliana. This is what we were given. This is what we were dealt. And the issue is, how do you find richness in that? How do you find meaning in that? And all I have to do is spend time in the pool with this little girl, and I've got, she's a ray of light looking in my eyes, and I get more from her than I give to her, and she's a treasure for me.
I guess you heard that a lot, this idea that this has profoundly deepened who they were as people.
I did. I heard it over and over again, and I really found there were a lot of cases in which it seemed to me to be true, and there were other cases in which I thought these parents are just talking themselves into this. And in the end, I decided it doesn't matter whether it's true or not.
Yeah.
What matters is whether it's part of the person's experience. And if the parents can experience their child's difference as in some way enriching or broadening them, and if the children, if they have sufficient consciousness to process this idea, can experience their difference as being in some way rich and rewarding, then everyone can behave better and be happier. The parents can be better parents. The child can be a happier child. Everything works out better. So even in cases in which I felt like, I wonder if those people are really just talking themselves into this, I thought it was a really valuable attitude to have. And then there were many cases in which I thought, you know, wow, look at this. I mean, there was one family of a dwarf whom I got to be very close to. And neither of the parents had gone to college. The mother was a phone operator. The father worked in construction. And when their child was born, they were told that he had diastrophic dwarfism, which was such a disabling condition that they should just leave him at the hospital and not take him home. Yeah. And instead, they took him home and they learned how to deal with his condition. And his mother, though it was pre the internet and she didn't have a lot of resources, managed to find her way to the best doctor to help him with his dwarfism. And he had 30 major surgeries during his childhood, as a result of which he actually can walk. And while he was stuck in the hospital all that time, there wasn't that much else to do. And so he worked on his schoolwork and he ended up being the first person in his family to go to college. And his mother described being in the car. He went to college not far from where they live, and driving past a bar and seeing his car. Clinton is the name of the kid. And yeah. She saw Clinton's car with all these special fittings to allow someone who's less than 3 feet tall to drive it in the parking lot of a bar. And she said, I just thought to myself, they're 6 feet tall. He's 3 feet tall. Two beers for them is four beers for him. She said, and I went home. I knew I couldn't go into the bar the way I wanted to and interrupt them. But I went home and sat by the phone. I called his cell phone 3 times and said, are you okay? She said, and then I thought, if someone had told me when he was born that my fear would be that he would go drinking and driving with his college buddies, she said, I would have been so thrilled to have that problem. And I saw that over and over again, people who really said, and she said, and he's accomplished things that I could never in a million years have done. She said, I don't know where that light came from, but we were lucky enough to be the first to see it in him. And that was a story I heard many times.
You know, Clinton talks about this, having this moment of revelation, and it seems like it's almost similar to the moment of revelation you have when he goes to this dwarf gathering, this convention. And it seems like in some way that – because you've written about – you write about the fact that when you went there and you write this, you say instead of seeing primarily people of short of stature, you saw one who was exceptionally beautiful, one who laughed a lot, one particularly intelligent face. And you say, I began to recognize how generically I had responded to little people until then. And I guess this was a moment of revelation in some way for you.
It really was. I found in all of these instances that I started off in these communities very uneasy. And I think I have some counterphobic tendencies and I tend to run toward things that frighten me. And I was not so comfortable with disability and difference of all of these various kinds when I started working on the book. And then I found that once you get into the context of this community, the deaf community, the dwarf community, the autism rights movement, even the community of people who commit crimes, which is one of the chapters later in the book, you really find when you get into any of these contexts, if you get deep enough into them, that there's a lot of beauty and a lot of comfort and a lot of nuance there that you hadn't previously guessed at. And so at that first dwarf convention that I went to, I was kind of struck by the fact that even though it was all about people being little, I wasn't experiencing everyone as, oh my God, look, there's a dwarf,
yeah,
but was rather feeling like these are human beings and here we all are together and what are the things we can talk about. For Clinton, going to his first dwarf convention, he just thought, I'm not the only one, I'm not alone. And when I talked to people in the book, frequently people who had difficult and complicated stories to tell, and I said, why did you decide to tell me your story? One after the next, they said, because I hope that if you write about this story, that someone else who's going through the process of discovering a condition like this won't feel as alone as I did. Mm. And I think that idea of community is central. And it's really why I set up the website at farfromthetree.com was because I wanted to forward that idea of community. I wanted to build as much community as I could.
Well, here's Clinton. Clinton Brown is his name, talking about going to that convention and that kind of revelation he has.
I made every friend that you could in the book. I was myself in kind of my skin for the first time in my life. I felt like I could be the man. And I ended up becoming a leader in the community because I guess that's naturally who I am. You know, big, tall, fat, or small. You are who you are. And so I was able to really connect with that side of me in this group. And I think it's helped me in a lot of other parts of my life, my career and other areas. So it's been great.
I love that because once he gets beyond the fact that that there are other people like him, then he moves on to something else, to focus on who he really is in his identity. Sure, is connected to him as being a dwarf, but that's only part of it.
Right. And he ended up actually chairing that convention when it came to Brooklyn, which is where he lives, a few years ago. So he went on to all of these successes, and he was finally someplace where he could, as he said, really be himself. Yeah. And that's what an awful lot of the people, the children, the parents, the families, that's what a lot of people want. They want a place where they don't feel under siege for being themselves.
801-585-WEST, the number two. Join the conversation. Let's take a call. Marge has been waiting in Logan, Utah. Marge, welcome.
Hi, Andrew. I am reading your book just now, and I'm really appreciating it. So thank you very much for putting everything together. I am the mother of two children with hearing loss, and I'm also a speech pathologist that joined the profession after my kids were diagnosed, and, you know, we've kind of gone through the whole process with them. But the comment that I wanted to make was that I think initially when our children were diagnosed, all we saw was the obstacles. We were like, you know, what are we going to do? We're living in a rural area. How are we going to get good services for our kids? Are they going to develop good language? And as we went through the process, we started learning that everything was an opportunity, and it really opened up opportunities for our kids, and we discovered a lot that way. And, you know, for instance, my son now wants to be a professional fiddle player, and it's just been a really neat process to go through. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. That, I think, is really the story that I set out to tell. And there's someone else who, if I'd heard the story sooner, I would have loved to include in the book itself, is that it's that story of revelation. I mean, often, you know, intimacy often occurs in moments of difficulty. So I want my children to be happy, and I do my best to make them happy all the time. But sometimes the time when I feel closest is when I'm comforting my son after a bad dream, or I'm helping my daughter get up after she's fallen and hurt herself and is crying. I mean, those are moments of enormous intimacy. They're moments of enormous intimacy between me and my children who don't have any disabilities. But dealing with a child who's going to present a challenge shouldn't undermine intimacy. In fact, often it pulls families together and makes them even closer than they'd be without it.
Marge, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Andrew Solomon is with us. His book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We'll also put a link to farfromthetree.com on our website. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Andrew Solomon. We're talking about his book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. I wanted to ask you about, I think it's interesting, you write about what it's like for parents who have children who have committed crimes. The parents of Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, boys who killed 13 people at Columbine High School in Colorado. They were part of the group of people that you spoke with, their parents. Were you always sure this category belonged in the book? Did you have any reticence? And what was it you wanted to understand about those dynamics?
I wanted to understand the idea that the children who present these challenges may present them not only because of the DNA or the physical brain that they're born with, not only because of those birth conditions, but that also children can present a challenge because of where they come from, which is why I did a chapter on families bringing up children conceived in rape, or through what they do, which is why I included the chapter on crime. And, you know, I felt like the parents of criminals were in for a particularly rough ride. I feel like we used to say that homosexuality was caused by overbearing mothers and passive fathers. And we used to say that autism was caused by refrigerator mothers. Yeah. And we used to say that schizophrenia was caused by parents who nurtured an unconscious wish that their child not exist. And I can go on and on in this vein. And we sort of stopped blaming the parents in a lot of those areas. But if you have a child who commits a serious crime, you're still seen by much of the larger society as having done something wrong. And people are still prone to saying, well, in our house, that didn't happen. You know, we brought our children up differently and better. And those parents, therefore, they deal with a lot of stigma and with a lot of loneliness. And I wanted to look at their experience and explore the idea that criminality frequently feels like a disease that someone is dealing with. And I was actually surprised as I worked on the chapter at how much of a similarity there was between the experience of those parents and the experience of parents of kids with autism or Down syndrome or any of the other conditions I looked at.
There's this really powerful moment in the interview with Dylan Klebold's parents. And you'd been talking to them for hours and hours. And at one point, you – and I guess you always do this in interviews. You ask, is there anything that – well, in this particular case, you say, is there anything you'd want to ask him, Dylan, or tell him? And there's this really powerful moment where his mother – well, tell the story if you would, because it's – kind of extraordinary.
So there we were. We'd done this weekend of interviews after years of negotiation to get to the point at which they were ready to be interviewed. We were all exhausted. We were sitting at the kitchen table. We were about to have something to eat. And I said, what would you ask Dylan if he were here now? And his father said, I would ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. Yeah. And Sue kind of looked at the floor and she thought for a minute. And then she looked back up and she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. It was a really breathtaking moment and a moment of great clarity. I had thought that getting to know Dylan Klebold's parents would explain to me why Columbine happened. I would see what the flaw was in this family that had led to that aberrant behavior. And I spent hundreds of hours with them over a period of many years, and I liked them and respected them and thought that they – I happen to have liked my own parents, but if I hadn't, I would have been happy to be brought up by these people. And I thought getting to know them only made the mystery deeper.
Yeah.
And when his mother said that, I felt as though she was tortured not only by sadness about what her son had done, but also by that sense that she had never really fully known him.
I guess that was a revelation for me in some way, because it's not as if there is some equation you have to work out and that you will ever figure this out. I mean, I think it, as you said, it became even a deeper mystery for you, and that seems to be the case in some of these stories that you tell. You don't know why, I guess.
You don't know why, and the why is unreachable.
Yeah.
And I came out of this thinking that you have to be prepared as a parent for the idea that your child can be or do anything. And you have to think through whether you'll be able to sustain love if your child does something that's shocking or horrifying to you. I mean, on a smaller scale, of course, everyone's children do things that are shocking or horrifying to them.
Right.
But how do you manage to get to the point at which your love is deep enough to endure something like that? And Sue Klebold said to me several years later when we were having dinner one night in Denver, she said, you know, I used to wish that I'd never gone to Ohio State, that I hadn't married Tom, that I hadn't had these children, because then Columbine wouldn't have happened, she said. But I've decided that actually, she said, life is painful and this is my burden of pain. And I love the children so much, the ones I had, that I wouldn't want to imagine a life without them. So while I recognize that it would be better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me.
I want to ask you about the final chapter of your book. Will you kind of reveal or talk a little bit more about your own kind of your own family, which is a very unique in some ways, but although, as you say, sort of this modern notion of what constitutes a family, five parents of four kids in three states, I think is how you sum it up, more or less, right?
Yes, that's, yeah. You've got it right.
Yeah.
So my husband, who I've known for 12 years now, is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minnesota. Then one of my closest friends from college, who'd gone through a divorce and said that she didn't really miss her husband, but she was sorry not to be a mother. She and I talked about it and decided to have a child together. And so I have a daughter who lives in Texas with her mother, and I see them a lot, and I'm the acknowledged father, and she has my name, and so on and so forth. And then John and I decided we'd like to have the experience of having a child with our with us full time, to really have the full-fledged parenting challenges and experience. And so we have another child of whom I'm the biological father. We had an egg donor, and the surrogate was Laura, who was one of the two moms of the kids in Minneapolis, of whom my husband is the biological father.
Yeah.
So it's very tangled.
Right.
Yes, the shorthand is that it's three households in three states, and the children all call me Daddy and call John Papa, and we have a very close relationship, and we try to do things all together as much as we can. They were just all up here for Christmas.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about – you write about this in the book, the day of George's birth. This was April 9th, 2009. You'd had a kind of, I guess, the normal sort of anxiety about the experience. And the doctor says, no, the baby's healthy. But then you notice there's this knot in his umbilical cord. And it raises these questions. And I wanted to have you talk about this moment and read this section from the book, if you would.
I'm happy to read that section. It was this young pediatrician who came in. It was the day after he was born, and said that she was concerned. Yeah. And here's what I wrote about it. George had not been drawing his legs up the way that babies are supposed to, and was instead holding them out stiff and straight for up to 3 minutes at a time. She referred to this as inappropriately high muscle tone and said that it might reflect brain damage, and that she wanted to order a CAT scan. I asked whether this was unusual, and she said simply that it didn't frequently occur at this stage. Laura brightly volunteered that George was going to be fine, and everyone else went on with the cinnamon rolls, and I felt the inside parts of my body that are usually warm go cold, while the parts exposed to the air suddenly seemed to be on fire. The pediatrician calmly explained that the baby's unusual behavior could signal bleeding in the brain, and that such bleeding might resolve itself or might need to be alleviated surgically. She mentioned the knot in the cord and said we needed to be certain that it hadn't had an impact. She noted that his head was unusually large, which could be related to hydrocephalus or the pressure of tumors. She added that he was stiffening one leg more than the other, which might mean that he had asymmetrical brain development or a mass in his brain. She was young, and I could tell that this was the steady, competent manner she had learned for the purpose of being honest with people. From the time George was conceived until that day, I had kept thinking how ironic it would be if, in the midst of writing about exceptional children, I were to produce such a child. I knew, though, that nature is no stranger to irony. Now, I asked how soon the CAT scan could be done, and the pediatrician said she'd set it up as soon as possible, and in her brisk and pleasant way, she left the room. I looked at George and knew I loved him by how hard I suddenly tried not to love him. I remembered all the parents who had described spreading the news about their thriving baby, and then picking up the phone a day or two later to report a different tale. A rational piece of me was trying to decide under what circumstances I would support whatever heroic measures might be called for. A terrified piece of me was contemplating giving him up into care. My strongest impulse was to hold him tight and not let him go for the tests at all. I wanted him to be well, but I wanted me to be well too. And even as I formulated that divide, it collapsed, and I saw that one thing could not be true without the other.
You write in the book, Andrew Solomon, about how over the last few decades, how our view about this interplay between nature and nurture has broadened. And you say in the book that this makes sense to you, of course, but you also say that having had children now, you wonder if there isn't a third element involved, what you called this unknowable inflection of spirit or divinity or whatever it was, this idea that children are our destiny. I wanted to ask you about that finally.
It's a huge question, but I ended up thinking that though I'm not deeply involved in organized religion, the idea that our children are random and that if we conceived them 2 days later, we'd have different children instead feels implausible to me somehow. I feel as though these are the children I had to have, and I hope that they will have the feeling that I'm the father or a father that they had to have. And I ended up thinking it's bigger and more mysterious than just nature and nurture. There is this feeling of fate, of divinity, of glory and exaltation, of strangeness and fear. There are these things that are much bigger than anything that we can comprehend. And I ended up thinking that for a lot of the parents in the book who had found resilience, some had found it in organized religion, but almost all had found it in some profound sense of the mysteriousness of parenting. And that was my theme.
Andrew Solomon, his book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, joined us today from New York City. Andrew Solomon, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.